Welcome to Inside Analog Photo. I'm your host, Scott Shepard. The Inside Analog Photo radio program is all about the traditional photographic process. We talk about all aspects of analog photography, including the hybrid workflow. You can find out more information over at www.insideanalogphoto.com. And of course, Inside Analog Photo is brought to you by Fujifilm, making life more colorful. These guys have the coolest instant photography materials known to mankind. They have, of course, the pack film in 3.25 by 4.25 and 4x5, color and black and white. They have the Instax systems in the wide format, the Instax 210 camera and film, and of course the Instax Mini in the Instax Mini 7 and the Instax Mini 25, both in color film. Beautiful stuff. There's nothing cooler than instant photography. You get a print, because if you don't have a print, you don't have a real photograph. This is great fun stuff. This is great for art. This is great for business. This is cool stuff. You definitely want to check them out over at www.fujifilmusa.com/professional, making life more colorful. Our friends over at Photo Publicist, providing worldwide publicity, strategic promotion, social media marketing, and business development for the photographer, turning photographers into celebrities. You can find out more information over at www.photopublicist.com. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab for the highest quality work known to mankind anywhere on this planet. Unbelievable developing, scanning, and of course, output on high quality Fuji Crystal Archive. Unbelievable cool stuff these guys are up to. And remember, you don't have a photograph unless you have a print in your hand, and you need to print your pictures. This is important. You need to supply proofs to your customers and even print your own work, because it's not about looking at it on a monitor. It's about holding a print in your hand. Definitely check these guys out at Richard Photo Lab, of course, at richardphotolab.com. Our friends over at DR5. DR5 Chrome Black and White Developing, that turns your black and white neg into, that's right, black and white chrome. Unbelievable stuff. www.dr5.com. Our friends over at Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com. For the camera strap that will not slip off your shoulder, guaranteed bar none, the coolest strap around. Our friends at Iger Studios for the finest quality drum scans known to mankind, IgerStudios.com. Our official media partner, APUG, the Analog Photography User Group, for all things traditional photographic process on the web, www.apug.org. And our official philanthropic partner, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film, over at www.eastmanhouse.org. Today on Inside Analog Photo, we're going to be here with Greg Miller. Greg is the recipient of the 2008 Guggenheim Fellowship. He's been teaching at the International Center of Photography in New York. He has his bachelor's degrees in fine art photography from the School of Visual Arts. Greg lives in Brooklyn with his wife and daughter, and he's a fabulous large format photographer. He shoots everything, but specifically, he shoots 8x10 color neg. He's got beautiful over-the-top work. He takes pictures of people. You know, really, he's a commercial photographer, but really at heart, he's a people photographer. He does commercial photography. He's been doing a lot of stuff, but he's got this body of work that is incredible. County fairs, marching band camps, Ash Wednesday, just so much beautiful work. He just shot a project with a 20x24 that backs up an earlier project that he shot in the 90s on black and white. Just a lot of great work. Greg's a great guy, and he's going to join us today to talk about his work and what he's been doing and his philosophies and thoughts on photography, and even more so on large format photography and all this beautiful, beautiful work. Greg, how you doing today?
It's going great.
Hey, thanks for joining us here on Inside Analog Photo. Great to have you on the program to talk about yourself and your fabulous photography.
Thanks for having me.
So tell me, Greg, you're a commercial advertising photographer based out of New York City. Tell me about how you got involved in photography. What made you want to go out and spend your days lugging around cameras and shooting cool stuff?
Well, I don't know if I would call myself an advertising commercial photographer first.
Really?
Yeah, I think the labels are so difficult, because what is a fine art photographer? What is a commercial photographer? I mean, in the end, I guess I think of myself as a photographer. But of course, I've made my living for over 20 years being a commercial photographer. So I am officially a commercial photographer.
But really, yeah. At heart, you're just a photographer that you'll do anything.
Yeah, I mean, I've always considered myself a fine art photographer, and I have always approached my photography like I was a fine art photographer. When I was in college, I fell into being a commercial photographer, and that's how I have survived all this time. In the beginning, I mean, I think for the first, 5 years, I didn't even have a portfolio. It was just word of mouth. It was the late 80s, early 90s, and there weren't as many photographers. And I would do anything for anybody. I did still life, I did dance, I photographed restaurants, anything at all. And it was an amazing learning experience. So it's funny because I really have always thought of that as a job. In fact, in the beginning, I remember being sort of apologetic about that to be my way of making a living. And I was sort of embarrassed. It's really hard to imagine now, because now there is no separation between fine art and commercial. We just don't have a separation anymore, and it is really just photography now. Because anybody who's showing in galleries right now probably has some sort of commercial career, and anybody who has a commercial career probably is showing in galleries somewhere. So, I mean, when I was in college, I think I thought that I just had some misperception probably about how that all operated. See, I've been feeling a little dismayed with the world lately, actually, not to get into that. I don't want to start out with a downer. But actually, in some ways, I'm very hopeful. I'm actually a happy guy. I'm happy, and I'm actually a humanist. It's funny, because I was actually thinking earlier today that it's almost like when I point the camera at people, something else happens. Because yesterday was kind of a rough news cycle day. I was reading the comments on some news yesterday, and somebody said, I just hate the world right now. And I thought, that's so true. And I just felt like I just didn't like the news. But then it's funny when I photograph things, even if I don't particularly agree with them, it's funny when I point the camera at things, there's some kind of compassion that emerges. And there's like a love of people that comes out in my photography. And I can have all sorts of complicated feelings, and my own personal feelings about news and the world is one thing. But actually, I do have a certain kind of love for people. And I think it is interesting to me how time and time again that comes off in my photography.
Well, no, I think it does. I think it's your whole attitude. And when you're in the cynical, everything sucks, everybody sucks attitude, it's hard to create nice, happy photographs.
Sometimes I wonder if people, they just come at my photography cold, almost has like a Hallmark kind of feel to it. I mean, I don't think they come off that way. I think there's also a dark thread through my photography. It's funny because it's almost like my intentions are not relevant. Really, when I point the camera at people, what happens, happens. And usually what does happen is I see people as human beings. And it's more complicated when I'm just sitting there. I think for me, photographing gives me a respite, a certain amount of peace. And that's why I think I continue to photograph. The world makes sense through my photography, whereas if I'm just like sitting here, it's just too overwhelming. I just think the way the world is going, the way the world is, it's just too much right now. But I do just love people. I find that the majority of people that I meet are actually good people. And I think that that's actually what comes through my photography. And I find that occasionally I do meet jerks, but I don't think that that's not the focus of my photography. What happens is if I meet somebody that I'm not connecting with, I don't feel them, if I'm not relating to them somehow, it just simply isn't a good photograph. So what happens is the pictures that you see, the pictures that succeed, are actually the people I connected with. Those are the people I felt. And I think there's something that happens there. And it's something I have partial control over. I can't go into it saying, I'm going to feel this person. I walk into it kind of just knowing, I don't know what's going to happen. Then I just meet people and I kind of fall in love. I mean, it really is like a crush. You can't walk into a bar and just say, I'm going to get a crush on somebody here tonight. You're not in control of that. You just walk into a bar and you just start talking to people. And I think that that's kind of the equivalent of me walking around photographing people, is that I really don't know what's going to happen. It's a little scary. In the same way love is scary, I think photographing people is also scary. You're out there and you're going to be basically hanging out with something you're not in control of. So I think that's kind of the hard part.
You're right, exactly. Most people are nice and good.
I think people have misperceptions about business. I think people think you have to be aggressive. I think you don't have to be that way. I think that you can be successful and be good. I mean, a lot of people haven't gotten that memo, but I think you can be a good person in the world and be generous, and I think you still can succeed.
You always try to do good, and then it just seems like the good people always get nailed first.
Here's an interesting point about that, actually. Is I teach photography at the International Center of Photography, and I teach a large format portraiture class. But in the end, it ends up straying from large format photography. It ends up being a photography class. And in that class, I do meet a lot of people that want to be photojournalists, or they are photojournalists. And it is interesting to me, because when I meet people that they're either photojournalists or they want to be photojournalists, that they understandably want to do good in the world. They have a talent, they're good at photography, and they want to go and stop a war with that. They want to go and like just save the world a little bit with that. And I think it's the same as wanting to be a fireman when you're a kid. Like, if you could pick any job in the world, wouldn't you want to be a fireman? Wouldn't you just want to save lives?
Sure.
And I think that for me in photography, I feel like to be a good photographer, though, it's a little bit of a selfish act. In the end, to make good pictures, you have to really satisfy yourself. So the greatest photojournalists in the world, they have first satisfied themselves, which is kind of a selfish act. In the end, they may help people, but they have first satisfied themselves, satisfied their soul, kind of. I think people want to skip satisfying their soul. And I want to tell them, satisfy your soul first. Be a little bit selfish. And of course, I'm saying this to people that walk in and they're selfless. They're not selfish enough. I would never be saying this to somebody who is too selfish. I get a room full of people that are selfless. They're afraid to satisfy themselves. And so I say, look, first satisfy yourself, and then you'll start making good pictures, and the rest will follow. Don't worry about it. You're a good person. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because I think in the end, my pictures started being better once I started being honest with myself that I wanted to make good pictures. Once I started telling people basically what I wanted, and it happened when I started shooting with an 8x10 camera. Because with an 8x10 camera, I can't just take pictures without people knowing about it anymore. When I shot with a Leica, you're a little bit invisible. I mean, I really do want to be invisible still. And it's funny, you can still be standing there with a wooden camera on a tripod, big wooden camera with a dark cloth. My dark cloth is silver. I mean, I scare horses when I'm photographing. But at the same time, though, you do become a little bit invisible. I mean, it's sort of how you carry yourself. Still, I go over and I tell people what I'm doing, and I still photograph largely the same way I did with a Leica. Just I walk around with a bigger camera. So I stop and I'll see somebody doing something that's beautiful, and I'll basically go over and ruin the picture. The first thing I do is I go over and I ruin the moment. I mean, I go over and I say, look, I don't know if you noticed, but that was amazing, whatever it was. And I say, listen, here's the deal. I take pictures and this is my camera and I wanted to take a picture of you. So I'm clear about my intentions. The camera is obvious. Often they see me before I see them. So something amazing happens, which is that they kind of understand and they basically do again what they did. Often they don't follow my instructions. They do something else that's even better. So it's this half serendipity and half my intentions, and somehow the good pictures emerge. But I'll tell you that I've found that the more I impose what I want on the picture, the worse it is. I learned a long time ago, shut up. I have to half tell them what I want and then half see what happens. And that's a really important ingredient. I mean, some people don't even realize when they first go to my website, they don't know that it's shot with an 8x10 camera. Sometimes still ask me, so these are all set up, right? Kind of that sort of thing. I mean, I shoot advertising. So set up to me is like I told everybody what to wear. We cast the whole thing. Like we have movie lights and stuff. I mean, I'm just walking around. I'm by myself. I don't have an assistant. I don't have lights. I just walk around with a wooden camera and I meet people and I respond to them and they're beautiful. And to me, that's not set up. That's me responding to the world.
No, and you can tell in your photography. So what made you want to actually be a photographer? I know that you're originally from Nashville, so how did this come about, and then how did you transfer and get to New York City? How does someone go from Nashville to Brooklyn?
Well, my earliest memories of photography were, like most people, National Geographic and magazines around the house. And my father was an amateur photographer himself, and so there were a lot of photographs of the family. He was something of an amateur artist as well, and I think this had a strong influence on me. When I first took my first roll of film when I was 15 years old, I developed it myself. It was black and white. It was Tri-X. And we had a little homemade kind of dark room and art room in Nashville. I had a great art teacher that was a huge influence on me. And when I first developed that roll of film, it was electric. He also said later to me, you were the first person who ever developed a roll of film and it came out well. It was well exposed and well developed. The thing is that for me, after that, I think photography was the way I saw. From 15 years old, I've really known that I wanted to be a photographer. I started photographing for my yearbook in high school, and then I became the editor of the yearbook, and then I got a scholarship to School of Visual Arts in New York, and I was in school for 4 years, but 2 years into School of Visual Arts, I started working for a magazine. It was a startup called 7 Days Magazine, which was published by the same people that published The Village Voice. So being the intern there, I would do anything. I was getting people coffee. I was doing paste up. I don't know if anybody knows what that is anymore. And I was sitting there in the art department next to the photo editor when she would hang up the phone and go, oh, what an asshole, to some photographer that was giving her attitude. And if a photographer screwed up something, she would just turn to me and say, look, can you do this? So I would end up getting the assignments if other photographers were either giving them attitude or screwed up or whatever. And that's how my career began. And I remember, I must have been 20 years old, and I remember Vanity Fair calling in my book, and I didn't have a book. I remember they called me and they said, oh, we really want to see your portfolio. And I remember I just threw something together. I didn't even know what to show them. Also, Elizabeth Biondi at New Yorker. So it's funny. I mean, I was like 20 years old. I was kind of a kid.
So let's jump forward on the book subject real quick. What do you do now in regards to portfolio book?
Well, now I actually just made a new one, and I have a portfolio that's a French fold kind of portfolio. It's printed on inkjet paper, and it's a large 11x14 book. It's really beautiful, I have to say. I'm very excited about it.
You're still in the process of, I have a real book and it's not on an iPad or on a website.
Well, I have my website, but it needs to be updated. It's like sort of the cliche of the modern times is that you have a website and it needs to be updated.
Well, it needs to be updated as soon as you're done, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, basically, that's why I think blogs are so successful. But no, I think still people want to see portfolios. People want to see the concrete thing. I've been reading about how successful iPads are, and I think photographers like them more than photo editors do or more than art buyers do. I think it's such a dream thing to be able to have your portfolio and you can have video going and all this stuff. I've been reading about mixed reviews on actually people being able to get a sense of your work from it. I do digital and I also shoot 8x10. It's impossible to shoot 8x10 all the time for commercial work. My file, it's big. It's a shame to just see this work on an iPad. I mean, iPads are cool and they're beautiful, but I mean, let's face it. I mean, I could show a 20x24.
Well, I mean, you don't have a photograph unless you have a print. So is it really a photograph if it's on an iPad, on a website?
Well, yeah. There's two different things. I mean, one is presentation and getting jobs and that sort of thing. And there's all these various ways of doing that. And I think some are better than others. I think iPads are good if I go. People can put it in their lap and they can flip through it or whatever. But I'll tell you, I still would rather prefer really have a box of 20x24 prints. I mean, people are blown away by that.
With shooting 8x10, that's very easy.
No, exactly. Those are like work prints for an 8x10. I think that you make an interesting point about seeing things on a monitor. I don't know if all photographers are like this, but I mean, having really grown up with and learned with prints, like seeing work prints and having this previous experience with so many prints, that I have a completely different understanding. If I just look at a bunch of pictures all the time on a monitor, it's as if there's a part of my brain that's just not receiving that information. Because I could just print all of them, look at them, and it's as if I've seen them for the first time. So I think it's really an interesting point. I think a lot of us get in the habit of just looking at things on a monitor because it's so much cheaper and it's easier. But I'll tell you that it really is an absolute necessary part of the process to look at your work printed.
Greg, tell me about this transition from 35 to medium, and then I'm just going to jump in and do 8x10. And 4x5, so the speed graphic deal. But tell me about this transition of these formats to actually get to the final point to say, well, for my good stuff, I'm going to shoot 8x10.
Well, there was a period of time, it was my first 10 years of working, 4 years of that was college, so I was learning, and I was really trying out different cameras. And it's funny, because back then, I was making pictures, and I had bodies of work, and I kind of thought that was it. I mean, I don't know, it wasn't like I was making bad pictures, but something happened when I started shooting with an 8x10 camera. People asked me, like, why do you shoot with this camera? I mean, today, and complete strangers, by the way. When I'm standing on the street with an 8x10 camera, I'm basically like standing there with a sign around my head saying, ask me why I shoot through this camera. But the switch, it's hard for me to say now why I switched exactly, but I just guess I wanted to try it out. But once I made a good picture with it, that was just like a dream. It's just so beautiful. I mean, it's just far away and beyond anything that any other camera can do. And listen, this is an important point, is that it's not about resolution. People get the impression that because there's like this kind of a megapixel war going on with digital cameras, it's kind of over now, but people got the impression that it's just about sharpness and resolution, and it's really not. It's about optics. You can't really create the optics of an 8x10 camera with any other camera. I mean, it looks similar with a 4x5 camera, but it's not the same. It's just not the same. I mean, it's a bigger lens and it's a bigger film area. So this is what I fell in love with. I fell in love with that early on, and I just cannot stop. And I don't particularly want to stop. I mean, it's funny because the world is changing around me. I mean, I guess someday they're going to stop making film, but I really do love it. And I think, to me, it's beautiful. I mean, it's beyond beautiful. It's like jazz. It's like if jazz were being threatened. The only way to hear jazz was a certain kind of paper, or we needed a certain place to hear that or something. I mean, I guess jazz may be threatened. I don't know. But I feel like photography, we've kind of lost our way a little bit. With 150 years of evolution of cameras and all these things, I feel like we've kind of turned our back a little bit. And now everybody is shooting medium format. After actually more than 150 years, I mean, they were making cameras before photography. We have so much of a base of every size camera imaginable and all this optics. And now we're all shooting with Hasselblad. Now, actually, I mean, truthfully, we're shooting with our telephones.
When you're doing editorial commercial work and other things that you're working on, do you prefer to shoot 8x10, or is it like, really doesn't matter at that point, it's digital, I'll just burn it and get rid of it?
I do prefer to shoot 8x10 if I can, but sometimes people do call me and they don't know what I shoot with. And I don't really want to have that conversation necessarily where I say, oh, by the way, I shoot with this wooden camera that's really slow and you're only going to get half the options you want. If it's a downer, I don't even approach the topic. because I can shoot with other cameras and I can do what is the essence of my work with other cameras. Because in the end, I mean, my pictures are about humans. They're about people, and they're about how people relate to each other. I mean, that's my forte. I don't like to get too far off on the camera because in the end, it's not about the camera. I could talk all day about the camera, but in the end, it's about what my pictures are about. It's about the way I photograph people and my response to people and how I see them. It gets back to what we were talking about in the beginning, which is that it's sort of a compassion that I see. I don't know how to say that. It's a difficult thing to talk about, but I could photograph it.
So you would classify this stuff as what, sort of like an environmental portrait?
Yeah, it is environmental portraiture. I guess it's sort of documentary, even though I totally take liberties with the situation. Like if the light is better 10 feet away, I move the people 10 feet away. And definitely, I want people to be photographed in their environment. It's hard for me to talk about it because some people even think I'm a photojournalist. And I don't even want to tell them that I'm not a photojournalist, but I don't think I am. One time I was showing my work in Time magazine and I had the whole photo department standing around the conference table. I had all my 20 by 24 prints laid out there and one of the photo editors said, "Are these all set up?" I didn't want to say yes because they're not exactly, but at the same time though, I told him, I said, "I'm not a photojournalist." Because I do ride that line of I photograph real people in real situations, but I totally engage them. I totally talk to them. I get release forms from everybody.
So let me ask you then, when you're taking these portraits and you're working on these bodies of work you're doing, do you find that besides the aesthetics quality of the 8x10, that the subjects play with the camera? How does it work out between your subject and the camera? Do you find that you get any kind of different look, feel, quality, emotion from you shooting the 8x10 over if, let's say, you're shooting a Blad or a Nikon 35 or whatever? Well, I guess we can separate them two ways. Everything else looks about the same except the large format. So do you figure the 8x10 changes the way people are conveyed in the camera, the way they're looking at you when you're taking the photo? Do you think that changes anything there or not at all?
Well, yeah, I mean, in the end, it is different. I mean, it's a wooden camera on a tripod and somehow they're responding to the camera. I do want to say also that I'm excited about the camera. I do love the camera, so it does bring something else out. However, if I'm in a position of photographing with a Hasselblad or something like this, chances are I'm on a job. It's not a camera I'm probably going to go out and photograph on my own. So when I'm in that position, I really do want to make the picture I would have made with an 8x10 camera. It's really important. And sometimes on jobs like that, I will actually even bring the 8x10 camera. Even if I don't use it, I'll have it. And I think it's important to be able to make the photographs that I want to make, that I see. It really is about seeing. This is what I often say when people are talking a lot about the camera, is that it's about how you see. In the end, like if I was just standing there without any camera at all, I would still be seeing exactly what I would see in a picture. And adding a camera to that is really the mechanism by which you capture what you're seeing. So in the end, yes, I can photograph with anything. But I know from experience, I photographed sort of for 15 years with an 8x10 camera. I'm married to it. It's like an extension. It's like a part of my anatomy at this point.
Let's talk about film. Film is a very important part of your photography. And let's talk about your aesthetic choices for what you shoot. Is it Kodak, Fuji, Ilford, all color, all black and white? What do you like to shoot? And is there a reason that you shoot a specific emulsion, or is it just because that's what's available for 8x10 and that's all you have?
I used to exclusively shoot black and white. That was when I was shooting with smaller formats. And then when I first started shooting the 8x10, I photographed with Tri-X. Then at some point, I switched to color. I'm sort of monogamous. When I switch cameras or I switch films, like I do it all in. I don't do 12 different formats. I don't try a bunch of different things. So I switched at a certain point to color. And I really kind of switched because I thought it was sexier. I have to admit. Like when I shot 8x10 color, like color negative, it's just beautiful. In the early days, like I remember Fortune magazine would require that I shot chrome. Everything was chrome back then. You couldn't shoot negative because it just looked like hell. There was no scanning it in or any of that. I remember when they told me that, I said, "I'm shooting 8x10. You know that, right?" But it didn't matter. In the end, I'm glad they stuck to their guns because, let's face it, I'm a professional photographer. Just because it's difficult doesn't mean you don't have to do it. You're a photographer. You're a pro. Shoot chrome. So I have all these chromes from those days. There's like stained glass windows, the 8x10 chromes. But in those days, because I would push the film, we would test the film. We would test the sheet and then run the next one accordingly if it was too dark or whatever. And hardly ever it was right on. I mean, even when I was doing Bellows Factor and all this stuff, I'm photographing people. It's just so difficult to get it right on. So I would take with me dozens of the empty film boxes with me on a job. If I traveled somewhere, I'd take with me 30 empty film boxes. And then each shot we did, we would download how many number of sheets were in the shot. We would shoot at exactly the same exposure, and then we put that shot into a box. And each shot was downloaded into a different box. So I would come back with like 20 boxes in the airport. In those days, I didn't care. I would say, oh, this is film. And they were like, okay. And they would just take it around the X-ray machine, no big deal. Then the lab would process them. We would run one sheet, and then we would run the others accordingly. So that's how we did that.
The current color neg stocks are fabulous, but there's still nothing like a piece of chrome on the light table, especially 8x10.
Yeah, no, it's true. It is a beautiful thing. Now I shoot with Portra NC160, which they still make. The 400 they stopped making, and luckily the 400 NC was never something that would appeal to me. I mean, I like the extra exposure, but it was kind of flat to me, and so I preferred always the 160 NC. So we'll see. Hopefully they'll keep making that.
So let's talk about the pool project on how you started off in the 90s in black and white, and you've just completed some additional work using, as I dubbed, the last great analog process of the 20th century on this project. The 20x24 Polaroid.
That was an amazing experience. The Asher Levy project was my first project that I did with the 8x10 cameras, where I basically learned how to use the camera. I went to a public pool in New York City. It was on 23rd Street, all the way on the east side. And I lived on the east side around that time, in the mid-90s. And I was kind of walking around one day, taking pictures, and I happened upon that pool. And you have to get permission to photograph in the pools. You can't just waltz in there with a camera and just start taking pictures. So what I did was, the fence around the pool was just wide enough that I could fit my lens through. So I set up my camera and I stuck the lens through the bars. I would say, excuse me, do you mind if I take your picture? I'm a photographer. So I'm standing with a wooden camera stuck through the bars. And I did a couple of portraits of people through the bars that way. And they actually turned out beautifully. They're actually on my website. So those first pictures I took are in the project. They're in the final edit. I went to the Parks Department, and I showed them those photographs, and I said I'd like to pursue this as a project, and they gave me 2 weeks at the end of August in 1995, and I went there every day, and I got to know everybody, and there's so many regulars at the pool, and there's also the staff and everything, and everybody's so wonderful. It's funny, because if I was shooting with a smaller camera, I think it would be so different. With a big camera, I'm not photographing anybody without their permission. Sometimes people way off in the background think that I'm photographing them without them knowing about it, but anybody in the background is out of focus. So I'm very clear with people that you're not in the picture. And sometimes people will still have some apprehension. It's an amazingly warm experience photographing with a camera. And to go into a New York City public pool where you would think people would be hostile, you would think people would be, don't photograph me and all this stuff, it's like the opposite. For me, photographing people all the time, I have to really gear myself up to that first encounter with people where I say, I'd like to photograph you. It takes a certain amount of courage. And then they're like, okay. And you just can't believe they just said that to you. You're just assuming they're going to say no. In fact, it's funny because just about any day that I go out and photograph, I just start out with a few no's. I don't really have a line. It changes every day. Whatever I say to people is always different. And so I kind of blow through a few no's. The fear of no is so great that I'll tell myself, just go for a no. If you're afraid of no, go for no. And then if you go for no, people are like, okay, you can photograph me. You get a yes if you want a no. So I think that it's like a little games I play with myself on the street, because it's lonely out there.
Well, see, I think a lot of people have a real problem walking up to strangers going, hey, can I take your picture? Especially in New York City with all these security concerns and 9/11 and all the stuff now where even the government won't let you take pictures anywhere, and it's just turning into this big mess. And people are scared to walk up and go, hey, you're cool looking. Let me take your picture, dude.
This is the thing about taking pictures in public is smile. I see so many people walking around with big cameras, like 35 millimeter with a huge lens. They look like they're going to combat. I remember once I saw it was a hot air balloon race. It was like the most beautiful, glorious day. Children playing, and it was a beautiful thing. It's like one of those Kodak moments, just beautiful. And I saw this guy with this huge camera. It was like a 35 with like a bazooka lens on it. And he had a vest, the whole thing. And he looked like he was going out to combat. He had this angry look on his face. He was so serious. His head, the bullets are flying. And I was like, dude, it's a hot air balloon race. I do remind myself is when I'm walking around with an 8x10 camera, you cannot go out there with a scowl on your face. You've got to smile. It's okay. Be friendly. Because people want to ask me. People look at me. I mean, believe me, if you walk in a room with an 8x10 camera, people look at you. And the reason they're looking at you is because you're a spectacle. The circus just came to town. So if you smile at people, you give them the in. They're like, oh, hey, what are you doing? What is that? And you give them the ability to talk to you. And that's what you want. You don't want to intimidate them. It's a very funny thing. I do see it a lot because I teach this. This is a big topic in my class, is approaching people. and the relationship of the photographer to human. We need them. I need them. I photograph people. I need them. I cannot be intimidating them. I cannot be scaring them away. So I've got a big camera. How do you make that accessible? How do I make me accessible to them? And that's done basically by smiling. I'll be sitting there with all my equipment and everything. I'll hold the door for people. You're a citizen of the world. Photographers forget this. When I'm on an airplane, I help people. I travel a lot. Is this different for photographers than it is for the average individual? When I'm traveling, I see a lot of people that hardly ever travel. And I see how hard it is for them. I mean, it's hard for us. It's hard for people to travel all the time. But I do feel for the people who don't travel that much and they're just thrown into this crazy way it is right now, this modern world. And if I can, I want to help. You don't have to be an NGO to help people. You can start small. Just help somebody with the door. You get a good seat on an airplane. You see somebody walking down the aisle with crutches, like, give them a good seat.
Sure, why not? You should. Do you find that with the students in your class, because you're teaching large format portraiture, that their biggest fear to overcome is actually going up to people and saying, hey, can I take your picture? Or is it the technical aspects that they're sort of freaked out about doing the 4x5 thing in front of people in public, or a large format portraiture compared to just walking up to somebody and saying, can I take your photo?
There's several hard things that my students have to overcome in my class. A big topic in my class is fear and overcoming fear. And I think because there's a fear, A, of when everybody's looking at you, if you have to talk to people and engage them, the first thing they'll ask you is, what do you want? And that's actually a very difficult question to answer. To say, I want you to stand, I want you to sit, I want you to lay down, whatever. So, I mean, what do you want? I think sometimes in my class, I realize that most of my students up to that point have only been capturing the world. They haven't had to ask. They haven't had to say what they want. They've only responded to what is there. So I think that's like one of the initial first things, is that my students have to first say what they want. And that's actually a very difficult thing. I mean, it's hard for us to tell our spouses what we want. It's hard for us to tell our significant other what we want, like a complete stranger. So I think going to large format from a small camera, it insists that you have some kind of understanding of what photography is. What makes a good picture good? So if you shoot with a small camera, you have a set of pictures that you like with that camera. To make your large format pictures as good as those, you have to look at those pictures and have some basic understanding of what made those pictures good to then translate that into large format. Then go into the world where you're kind of engaging people and talking to them. How do you do that? That's a process over weeks. It takes time. And actually, people are very impatient. If you're learning only with digital photography right now, you don't even remember learning with your camera. You probably didn't even read a manual. You probably just started. So kind of throw somebody back into learning how to use a camera, it's very uncomfortable. And so I'm very patient with my students. I hope they see it that way. I'm not sure if they see it that way. But I'd like to think I'm very patient with them because I know it's very difficult. And I want them to kind of be patient with themselves. So if I'm being impatient with them, I know they're going to be impatient with themselves. So I want to shower them with patience so that they will be patient with themselves.
How have you found that getting the Guggenheim grant in 2008 changed what you've been shooting or doing? I mean, it's great to get the fellowship and you get the money and it's cool, right?
Yeah, that's a very powerful thing. When the fellowships were announced in 2008, I remember reading on a blog somewhere, had the names of the winners that year. My name was among them. And I remember reading in the comments of that blog, somebody saying, I don't think there's a Robert Frank among them, because Robert Frank was the best known Guggenheim fellow of them all.
Well, Paul Caponegro's in there. There's a few good ones.
It's really good company, and it's really intimidating. But what's funny is that when I got the fellowship, the first thing I thought of is, you want to be as good as Robert Frank, and that's just not going to happen. I mean, Robert Frank is the greatest of them all. I'm not trying to be Robert Frank, but I want to do it service. I take it very, very seriously. I did receive a Guggenheim Fellowship. My national project was what I created from that, and I wanted it to be mammoth. Well, I do understand of people that have received the fellowship, I think you want to do something big. And often, you do something bigger than you can do.
These places that you've shot, because you've shot all over the world, where's your favorite place to take photos? Because you are taking pictures of people. So is it the Europeans? Is it New York City? Is it the fine folk in Nashville? That I find is a very inviting town. I love Nashville.
I love Nashville too. Nashville is a great, great city. I have to say, if I were to throw my affection on one group of people, I think I love New Yorkers the best. Because I started here and I am still here in many respects.
Is it because of the diversity of so many different ethnic type people and all over different little boroughs that it's such a unique place?
It's like the world coming to you. Instead of having to go to a place where everybody is like a certain way, you come to New York and you basically just take your pick. And it has so many different things. You just take Queens or Manhattan. They're just different aspects. I mean, New York easily is the greatest place to photograph. In just a general sense, I would say that. These days, though, the way I photograph, it's not the same as when I was younger. When I was younger, I could just walk out the front door and I could just spend a day kind of walking around, just looking at the world. And now I think I like to photograph towards a certain project. And so in that sense, New York is not as satisfying to me. So just in terms of pure, like, people watching and just diversity of people, New York is it. But Nashville was amazing because, on one hand, I mean, there's amazing diversity in Nashville, but I'm not always looking for diversity. I'm looking for people really being themselves. And that's what makes my pictures true. If I make a picture that looks set up, it's bad. It's like a B-movie or something. If you don't believe my pictures, it sucks. So I need the people to be real. And that's why I go to certain regions or certain places, certain things that have appealed to me.
Tell me about this latest show you had with Aline Smithson.
Oh, yeah. In Barcelona.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was awesome. And Aline and I didn't know each other before that. And we were kind of thrown into that show together. The owners of Gallery Tagamago, Vicens and Valerie Boned, they decided to have a show that was East Coast and West Coast American photographers in Barcelona. So I represented the East Coast and Aline represented the West Coast because actually she's now in L.A. The photograph, those great photographs of her mom, the group of photographs, they're just so beautiful. I mean, they're really heartwarming.
Very heartwarming, and I think the combination of what your stuff was and hers looks to be a great show.
It was a great show, and we had a great time. I took my family over, my wife and my daughter. We have a 4.5-year-old daughter, and her name is Joya. And then actually we went to Italy after that, and I made some more photographs over there. So all in all, it was a great trip.
So Greg, tell me, out of all of the stuff that you've been shooting and doing and just completely immersed in this whole analog deal, what do you want to do? What are you looking to do moving forward? I mean, you've shot some stuff on the 20x24 that's over the top. You're shooting 8x10 color neg. You're doing all kinds of great work, but what do you want to do next?
I really want to focus on publishing books.
So do you want to publish a complete works of what you've done?
No, I want to publish relatively small books, but I want to publish a particular body of work. So it'll be maybe county fairs or Ash Wednesday or Nashville and kind of move towards that.
And this is like a print-on-demand, press blurb type thing?
No, I want it to be a real book. It's going to be published by a publisher. I mean, if I have to self-publish it, I'll do that. I guess I'm moving my focus to a love of books. I love books. I love photo books. But it hasn't been my focus. I really have focused nose to the grindstone just making pictures for 25 years. It just hasn't been my focus. I mean, some people early on fall in love with bookmaking, and that just wasn't my focus. So my focus is changing. In the same way that at a certain point I picked up shooting with an 8x10 camera, now I would like to really embrace publishing books. And I think it changes the way you shoot. I think it changes the way you approach. That's what's important to me right now. But I'm going to continue shooting projects, and I have a new project that's photographing drive-in movie theaters. It's called Waiting For. And it's people waiting basically for the movie to start, sitting around in their cars and stuff in the summer. And I'm going to continue photographing county fairs, and I'd love to continue shooting Nashville. So, I mean, I'm sort of a cyclical photographer, so I won't give up on a project. I'll shoot something, and I'll shoot it year after year after year. For example, Ash Wednesday I've been doing for over 10 years. County Fair I've been doing since 2005. So I do reapproach them, and for a while I get kind of busy because my schedule is filled throughout the year with all these various projects that I continue.
Of course, you're teaching at the International Center for Photography in New York, but are we going to see some workshops or any other type of enlightenment available from Greg that other people can attend and learn from, or do they need to go to New York?
Well, there's ICP, and I was starting to talk to main workshops, and hopefully something might happen over there. I'd love to do something that was in the same vein of shooting large format or approaching people, that sort of thing. A very long-term goal of mine, I would love to have sort of a photography retreat. I mean, I know there's a lot of people that do this sort of thing. I mean, I know it's not completely original, but I would love to have a place where people could come and sort of just spin their wheels and be part of a creative community and just sort of be inspired. Because sometimes, actually, I've noticed that if you stop and you have silence, it gives you energy. I think that ICP, International Center of Photography, these are very intensive programs, and that's good. I mean, Eddie Adams' workshop, for example, is very intensive, and that's an understatement, really. That's very useful. But at the same time, though, I think there's also something that happens in complete silence where inspiration can occur. And so I had this idea to do something like that for people who would be interested in that sort of thing. where you could watch films, there'd be writing and be talking in groups and that sort of thing in a beautiful environment. That's a long-term goal I have.
Great goal, though. Why not? You could do anything you want to as long as you want to do it.
Yeah, there you go.
So let's talk about, Greg, where people can see this fabulous photography. Give us your address to your website and your blog. This is great stuff.
So my website is www.gregmiller.com. My blog is darkclothdiaries.com. That's all one word. There's actually several Greg Miller photographers. I don't know if you've noticed. If you Google Greg Miller photography or photo, there's five that I know of off the top of my head. But I mean, really, it's amazing. It's such a common name. But at any rate, I'm gregmiller.com.
There you go. So I think people really should go look at your work because there's something to it that's very unique and it's just beautiful photography. It's very inspirational.
Well, thank you very much.
It is great stuff. And we definitely look forward to having you back on the program, Greg, to talk about stuff. We could go on here for hours, but I think this gives people a little insight about what you're doing. And this is just beautiful photography. Great work.
Thank you. Thank you. And I would love to come back anytime.
Well, there you go. Greg Miller, what a great guy. Beautiful photography, such an inspiration. You really need to look at his website, www.gregmiller.com. Greg's going to join us some more talking about other aspects of photography. His work is fabulous. Really go look at it. It's an inspiration, and I think you'll find there's so many different things that you can take away from his work. It's just fabulous. Definitely check out Greg's website, look at his work, and look forward to more Greg Miller here on Inside Analog Photo. The Inside Analog Photo radio program has been brought to you by Fujifilm for their full line of instant cameras and film and, of course, fine-quality Fuji Crystal Archive paper over at www.fujifilmusa.com/professional. Our friends at Photo Publicist, worldwide publicity, strategic promotion, social media marketing, and business development over at www.photopublicist.com. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab for the finest quality lab in the country, richardphotolab.com. Our friends over at DR5 for black and white chroma at dr5.com. Upstrap for the finest quality camera strap that will not slide off your shoulder at upstrap-pro.com. Our friends over at Iger Studios at igerstudios.com. And of course, our media partners of the Analog Photography User Group at apug.org. And our official philanthropic partner, George Eastman House, over at eastmanhouse.org. I've been your host, Scott Shepard, here on Inside Analog Photo. We'll be back next week with more great analog photography.